Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. And with me in the studio is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
Good to have you. And when I said hello again, everyone, I want to just remind you that we're talking about Just the Best Literature. This is not Shakespeare. So in case I mixed you up, I'm really trying to clear all that up. So actually, I think I had a comment for today, but my trusty assistant was trying to help me organize my office. We're back into classes. And somehow I think that comment got pushed somewhere else and I couldn't find it this morning. So if you've sent me a comment and I haven't read it, just send it again and I'll try and see if I can find it. But anyway, we don't have a comment for today, but I have a lot to say. So we'll deal with that. Now, on our last program, I delved into part two. And it's called Into Africa, and we were in chapter 5, and that is titled Send Her Victorious. Now, what I want to do for today's podcast, I want to finish chapter 5 and then begin discussing chapter 6, and that chapter is titled We Have Now Gone Far Enough. Now, chapter 5 gave us insight into the British view of the coming Boer War. But chapter 6 now gives us the Boers' view of the British and how to wage war. So we're actually, hopefully all of you out there, you're getting really excited about, you know, Winston and the Boer War. We're getting a step closer. So I think by the next time we do another program, we're going to be standing in the battlefield with Winston Churchill and the Boers. So again... I think this is going to be really good. So today, let's begin discussing chapter... Well, no, let me finish chapter 5. We'll go to the top of page 64. And what I want to do is just focus on a few things here. So this would be the first full paragraph on page 64. It says, whatever Churchill might have believed about the commander-in-chief, however, and he's what Candace is talking about is she's talking about the military leader Buller. So let me just go back to this. Whatever Churchill might have believed about the commander in chief, however, Buller was under no illusion when it came to the Boers. Although he hoped that he would arrive before the fighting began, he was certain that when it did begin in earnest, England would find itself in a war unlike anything it had ever seen. And so in some ways, what we're going to find out is Buller actually had a pretty good handle on what was going to happen. Not everybody felt the same way. Now, here's why. It says Buller knew South Africa, and more than any other general in the British Army, he knew the Boers. In fact, when the members of the War Office Intelligence Branch had rushed to gather everything they had on the Boer Republics, bind it into two volumes, and sent it to him, he had dismissively sent it back, attaching a note, wearily reminding them that he had already knew everything about South Africa. Okay, so now, he hadn't been there for a while, so South Africa could have changed, but he thought he really knew about everything. Now, let's just, we're going to slip down just a little bit more. The middle of the page there, it says, 20 years during the Anglo-Zulu War, Buller had fought with the Boers rather than against them. He had won his Victoria Cross, the highest award given by the British military for his gallant conduct during the war, and he knew that he owed much of his success to the Boers who had ridden next to him time and again, untiring and unafraid. As the British Secretary of State for War, Henry Lansdowne, had disdainfully remarked, Buller talked Boer, and in stark contrast to nearly any other man in the British military, he openly admired their courage and skill. So Buller has some real insight into the Boers, and in some ways he could have maybe slipped a little bit and not really put up with what the British want, the book they wanted him to read. But I'm going to go down to the next paragraph. It says, Buller, however, like Churchill, was trapped on the sea while other men were running to the war. Worse, those in charge, and that this was Penn Simmons and General George White, were quite possibly the last men who have been chosen for the job. White, who had worn his Victoria Cross, won his Victoria Cross, excuse me, in Afghanistan, had never before fought in South Africa. And so you're here, you have George White. Again, he's another general. And the Candace goes on to write, the army at large was quite as much astonished as the civilian world at the appointment of Sir George White to the command in Natal. A reporter for the Daily Telegraph wrote, in the clubs and messes it had been taken for granted that the head of the force sent to the Cape would be men having experience of South African warfare. Penn Simmons knew South Africa, but had no respect for or interest in the Boers. Whatever the estimate formed of the fighting quality of the Boers, Leo Armory, a journalist for the London Times, wrote, no one rated it lower than Sir William Penn. Sir William Penn Simmons. Now, this is, we're over to page 65, and that will get us to the very end of this chapter 5. It says, although Penn Simmons and White had only 12,000 men between them and were astounded by more than four times the number of fighting Boers, they did not for the moment worry that they would have any difficulty holding the enemy at bay until Buller arrived. Personally, and this is personally what George White said, personally, White had nonchalantly told her friend the day before he set sail from Southampton's, I don't believe there will be fighting of a serious kind. All right, that's a dangerous statement to be making. And anyway, so I wanted to focus on George White because remember that statement. Personally, I don't believe there will be fighting of a serious kind. Well, we're going to see where this really goes. All right. So remember now, I'm going to take you back to the last podcast just to help you maybe catch up here. Joseph Chamberlain, remember him, he held the belief that the war would be short-lived. And now this is when they're on the Dunnottar, that's right. Churchill met Joseph Chamberlain at that big party of, I forget what her name was, Lady something or other, and they were all getting excited about, what they could be doing. But Chamberlain held the belief that the war would be short-lived. It wasn't going to last long. Churchill thought the men aboard the Dunnottar Castle were blasé about the war. And we have to remember now, that was on page 63, by the way, if you want to go back and read it. But remember, Winston wanted to participate in this war to advance his political life. That's what he wanted. I mean, he wanted the war to really be exciting, and he could maybe, make some big political move or make some war move, and it's going to make him more famous, and then he's going to be better at politics than he is, relying on his dad's background. So anyway, remember now, he was really looking forward to this, to get the big photo, of on a horse or whatever, and he was, winning the war with the Boers. But as we go through this, we're going to see it wasn't quite like that. Now, I want to just finish chapter 5 now, and this is page 65 at the top. And it says, although Penn and Simmons and White had only 12,000 men between them and were surrounded by more than four times that number of fighting Boers, they did not for a moment worry that they would have any difficulty holding the enemy at bay until Buller arrived. Personally, White, I think I already read this, has said that I don't believe there will be fighting of a serious kind. And so we're going to see that is very stupid thing to say. All right, now let's just go over to page 66 and just turn the page. And now we are in a new chapter. And it's interesting enough that when we start reading now chapter 6, we're going to find it's very interesting that the Boers are not even in a panic. they're not even worried. And essentially the reason why, for everybody out there listening, they're naturally prepared for war all the time. Remember, they live in South Africa. And remember, they've taken over native land. And sometimes the natives want their land back. And they also have to fight lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. So here's let's start at the very top of page 66. Now, the title of this chapter is We Have Now Gone Far Enough. And I'm not sure why she named it that. I think we'll have to really think about that some. So she writes, now this is the top of page, the first paragraph. So whatever waves of panic the British Army might have imagined ripping through the Transvaal as news of war spread to its farthest reaches, the reality was starkly different. In the days leading up to the ultimatum, the Boers were not frantically preparing for war, rushing together maps and men, supplies and ammunition. They didn't have to. There had never been a time, either in their own lives or in those of their forefathers, when they had not been ready to fight. For the great majority of Boers, as soon as war seemed imminent, there was nothing little to do but leave for the front. So here you have the Boers, you know, the British, you know, think about the British. They've got to have the right outfit on. They've got to have their hats right. You know, Winston Churchill had to have bottles of champagne and wine sent with him. You know, he had to take his valet, I guess, or say valet, I guess, with him so he could wash his clothes for him and take care of him and all that. Boers don't have anything like that. So, it's interesting that the Boers were not in a panic. And I'm going to read you a little bit more now how prepared they were for war. I got to turn to my page. There we go. So what I want to do now is read the second paragraph on page 66. It says, in isolated farms across hundreds of miles of South Africa, from the Drakensberg Mountains in the vast plateaus of the Highveld, every Boer man and boy between the ages of 16 and 60 and much older or younger than that set out for war. So essentially what Candace is bringing out is the Boers were always prepared for a war because the natives could come after them. You know, they had to fight for this land. And, you know, so it was really, really interesting. She goes on to write, it says, there was no need to enlist in the army because there was no standing army. And there was no need to find a uniform because there were no uniforms. Uniforms were something soldiers wore, and Boers were fiercely adamant that they were not soldiers. And that's interesting. It's a term they found deeply offensive. They referred to themselves only as burghers or citizens. And so you can see the love of their country. They were just very pleased to be citizens or burghers. He says, when we left for war, a Boer pulled on the same clothes he wore every day, homemade shoes, a pair of stiff moleskin trousers, and a wide-brimmed hat to keep the sun and rain out of his eyes, all of it in the same drab grays and browns. The only flourishes he might allow himself were affixed to his hat, either a small flag of the Transvaal sewn into the fabric, or as a nod to the customs of the past, a meerkat tail, dark-tipped and slightly bushy, tied to the upturned brim. And so, I really love meerkats, by the way. You know, when my daughter and her husband and my grandchildren were, you know, in Toledo, they had a really nice zoo there. And they're little meerkats, and they pop up out of their holes, and they're really cute. But you know, the Boers cut their tails off. Anyway, this is it. She goes on to talk about the soldiers and the men and their sons. Says as he walked out the door, his wife or mother handed him a linen sack with enough food to allow him to survive on his own for several weeks. And so this is how the Boer women felt about war. You don't see them crying at the door. You know, you don't see anything like that. They trusted their husbands and their sons, but they made sure they had enough food. It says he was accustomed to living on just a handful of staples, coffee, brown bread, and biltong, which is a dried meat made from anything from beef to zebra or giraffe and cured with a mixture of vinegar and spices. So notice what they did not carry with them. That Winston Churchill just had to have champagne, the best wine. They had nothing like that, you know. Anyway, it goes on here to say, his native servant. So now this is interesting. The Boer men did have servants. And but this is what their native servants do for them when they go to war. I mean, it's not what was going to happen with Winston and his valet. And it says, his native servant hooked a roll with a rough blanket and a raincoat onto the front of his saddle and a kettle to the back, likely wearing a wide bandolier over his shoulder, and with a Bible tucked into his pocket, he climbed onto his horse and rode off with little more than a backward glance. Now, when I was getting ready for today, that really impressed me, to see that here are these Boer soldiers, and they're really just regular farmers is all they are, and they had to have a Bible tucked with them. And one of the things I think we have to understand, that the Boers really considered getting South Africa like they did. They considered it a gift from God, and they were very religious people. And they really did have, you know, a religious sense about them. So after he had his Bible tucked in his pocket, he climbed onto his horse and rode off with little more than a backward glance. You know, it's not like there's going to be a lot of tears crying, leaving your wife and leaving your home. They just wanted to get out and get it done. Now, it says, by early October, thousands of Boers had already flooded into Pretoria, the Transvaal capital. And so you have to think about this, is, you know, they were waiting for the British, but they were getting ready. I mean, they were really getting there. They're at the capital. It says the town, which had been built in a warm, fertile valley north of Johannesburg, about 350 miles from the eastern coast, seemed far less a bustling center of political power than a sleepy frontier outpost. Although the wide streets and large government buildings clustered at each end, most of them were made of dirt. And she's talking about the streets. Most of the streets, they weren't finished. They were basically dirt, with some small streams running beside them. The home of the president, this is Paul Kruger, the Boer president, had two imposing stone lions standing guard at its entrance, a lavish gift from the British mining magnate Barney Barnetto. But Kruger's wife, the first lady of the Transvaal, could often be seen out front milking their cow. So even the president is still into farming, you know, his wife is the first lady. Can you imagine the first ladies of America out on the White House lawn milking a cow? You know, and so these are just down-to-earth people. And, you know, they love their families. They love their country. They love God. And it's really interesting. He says, with the onset of war, the usually quiet town had been rapidly transformed. Trains arrived every day crowded with burghers from all corners of the Republic. Hundreds of heavily bearded men. Now remember what George White said, this is not going to be bad. This isn't going to be tough. They already have hundreds of soldiers ready. And she goes on to say, clearly unused to and uncomfortable with being anywhere but their own farms, wandered the town, and a crush of horses kicked up the dirt streets until everything and everyone was coated with fine red dust. On the day before the deadline for the ultimatum, if you remember now, as they wrote the ultimatum, you have to answer us by sunset or it's war. And so we know that the British let it go and the war was declared. So on the day before the deadline for the ultimatum, which also happened to be Kruger's birthday, the town even did something very un-Boer-like. It had a military parade. So they've never done that. Can you imagine? The British, they love their military parades. And they like to parade the king or the queen, in their specially made, I don't know what you would call it, I guess buggy. They'd probably slap me if I said buggy. But anyway, as their command general, Pierre Joubert, or Joubert, the man who had led the victory to the victory against the British 20 years earlier, stood in silent and awkward appraisal. His men rode past him one by one in their own makeshift version of military review. Even Dennis Reitz, the 17-year-old son of Francis William Reitz, the Transvaal's Secretary of State, and the man who had written the ultimatum, could tell that there was a striking lack of uniformity among the men, or even apparent plan to military exercise. So it was not going to be an organized, march like you would have in England. And I've been to England more than once, and I've been to the castle, and it's always great to see the military. Changing guards at the Blenheim Palace is amazing, and it's got the good. They're so British. You could make faces at them and they won't laugh. They won't do anything. But it is. It's so colorful, and they're pretty tough. If you stick your hand through the fence, they're going to come for you. So we had to tell our grandchildren, keep your hands away from the fence. So he says, although it was magnificent to see commando after commando file past, he wrote, each man brandished hat or rifle according to his individual idea of military salute. So they didn't really know how to do the military salutes like the British, but they could tip their hat or they could put their gun in the air or their rifle. And so I think this next paragraph by Candace is just great. She writes, had they been able to witness the scene, the British military would have mocked it as unworthy of any military tradition. The rifles the Boers were holding, however, would have gotten their attention and stolen the smiles from their faces. Accustomed to fighting colonial wars against enemies who had little more than a few antiquated shotguns, the British War Office assumed that, at best, the Boers would be carrying the outdated Martini Henry carbines they had used during the First Boer War. They could not have been more wrong. And so again, the British are just assuming all these things, and it's not what is really happening. It says, for years, now listen to this, they think they're stupid dummies and farmers. But listen to this. This is really, be smacked by all of this. This is really, I'm really glad to be reading this book, by the way. And it's a little different than what, Winston probably would have been writing. He says, for years, the Boers had been making one critical concession to war preparedness. They had been stockpiling weapons since the Jameson raid. And that was, with the British. Cecil Rhodes' disastrously failed attempt to take over the Transvaal nearly 4 years earlier, Kruger had been sending men to Europe to buy the most effective and modern weapons available anywhere in the world. In particular, the Boers had been amassing German Mausers, a magazine rifle that was not only lighter but faster loading than the Lee Enfield, the rifle the British Army had been using since 1888. But in 1895 alone, the Boers bought 10,000 rifles and roughly 12 million rounds of ammunition, which they stored in a fort in Pretoria. So here, they were ready. That's a lot of bullets. The following year, the Secretary of State for War, Louis D'Souza, had gone back to buy more. As good as the guns were, the men using them were even better. Even the British had to begrudgingly admit that when it came to marksmanship, it was impossible to compete with the Boers. I wonder how the Boers did at the Olympics. I don't know. It says, whether they're talking about the Boers and their marksmanship, whether they were hunting lions, which raided their herds of cattle and the flocks of sheep and posed a threat to their families, or fighting the native Africans, whose land they now occupied, their lives depended every day on the speed and accuracy of their shooting. They were the finest mass of rifle-armed horsemen ever seen, Churchill wrote, and the most capable mounted warriors since the Mongols. So, the British are going to have a big surprise coming for them. Well, everybody out there, that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, on our next program, we'll continue to discuss Candace Millard's book, Hero of the Empire, Part 2, Into Africa, Chapter 6. And I promise you, we will finally stand on the battlefield with the British, the Boers, and our hero, Winston Churchill. And so, this book is a wonderful supplement to Winston Churchill's book, My Early Life. Now, you can buy a used copy of Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com. Now, please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.